Right? Right, Hal said. Karn studied him, as if deciding whether he should give back a measure of information in return for Hal's. Our new king is moody and unpredictable, but I think I'm safe in saying that the only way Jarrett will make peace with the Thanes is on his terms. He believes that his hostages will keep him safe, that they are the argument no one can answer. And now, thanks to Hal and Robert, the king had two more hostages than he did before. He doesn't know my father very well, Hal growled. No, he doesn't. And unfortunately, when Jarrett hears about Chalk Cliffs, that will reinforce his decision to take a hard line. Perhaps if I spoke to King Jarrett, I could convince him that... That's not a good idea, Karn said. I realize that it's a risk, but... The king doesn't know that you and your brother are here. So, that could be awkward. Hal glanced at Robert, then back at Karn. He doesn't know we're here. Karn shook his head. I thought it best not to bother the king with this matter. He has been very busy trying to form a decent council out of the few Thanes who have remained loyal. He straightened his sleeves, wrinkling his nose. The social season has been a disaster. It's a good thing that the marching season isn't far off. But if we're here in custody, doesn't... This is my prison, and the guards are my people. They have learned not to be curious. Besides, as I said, you're dead. That's an advantage, as you'll find. While they'd been talking, Robert had grown more and more restless, shifting in his chair, clearing his throat, and so on. Now, apparently, he could not remain silent any longer. "What if the hostages were freed?" he blurted. "Do you think that would influence King Jarrett's willingness to compromise?" "Possibly," Karn said, his cool gaze brushing over Hal's brother. "Or it might inspire the Thanes to attack." "They are going to attack anyway," Hal said. "Trust me on that." "I do trust you on that, Captain, which is very odd," Karn said. "Unfortunately, it's highly unlikely that His Majesty will give up what he sees as a winning hand." "I'm not suggesting that he'll free them," Robert said. "I'm saying that we should free them." "Won't that be difficult, locked up in a cell as you are?" Robert's enthusiasm withered. "Oh, well, I thought perhaps you could free you, or join with you in freeing the hostages. Are you suggesting that I commit treason, Corporal?" Karn shook his head. "I'm careful about who I partner with. Given your performance so far, I'd be going to the block in no time at all. Have a little patience. In the meantime, are you comfortable? Are you getting enough to eat?" "Yes," Hal said. "The food is much better than in the prisons in the north." "That's what everyone says," Karn stood. "Gentlemen, you'll hear from me soon." After the door closed behind him, Hal heard the bolt sliding shut. "Do you think he's going to help us?" Robert said, glaring at the closed door. "I wish I knew," Hal said. Time was passing, and both the Empress and the Thane armies would soon be on the march. There was no way to know who would arrive in the city first. Chapter 32 Weeping Sister. For the first few days of the crossing, the weather was blustery and cold, typical for early spring in the northern oceans. Personally, Brion enjoyed the ride, spending as much time as possible on deck, chatting up the crew and asking questions about the ship, the rigging, and the ports they'd been to, gathering information that he hoped to use later Most were the Empress's purple mages, and they were a dour lot, not particularly receptive to his considerable personal charm. Gradually, though, they grew to tolerate him, allowing him to help them in their work and join them on their watches. The Siren was built for speed and maneuverability, and not for the tender stomachs of day sailors. Her Highness huddled miserably in her cabin until Brion finally managed to coax her up on deck. Once they were there, he advised her to put her face in the freshening wind and fix her eyes on the horizon. After that, she was less prone to spewing, which made their shared cabin a lot more livable. Since that day on the beach, when she'd murdered Aubrey, the Empress had been sweet, solicitous of their comfort, so kind that butter wouldn't melt in her mouth. Brion listened hard for Celestine's music, but he heard only the raging storm, the crash of thunder, the creak of the masts, and singing of the lines as the sails filled, and the flapping of the sheets when they lost the wind. He watched and waited, looking for a chance to get hold of one of Celestine's belongings that might give him a clue. But she was exceedingly wary of him, as if she knew all his tricks and how to sidestep them. He meant to make her pay for Aubrey somehow. Now that he was clean, he seemed to have lost his limitless ability to make excuses for himself. He'd done some low-down things in his life. He understood what it was like to have nothing and want something, and know that the only way to get it was to take it. His manager, the street lord Wax, had taught him that honesty was something only a blue blood could afford. And then he'd come to realize that most blue bloods lie and cheat and steal even if they don't have to. The only difference was that their takings were bigger, and they nearly always got away with it. As they neared their destination in the Northern Islands, the seas rose and the weather worsened. A howling wind drove needles of rain into their faces and made it all but impossible to remain on deck. Visibility was so poor that Brion couldn't see more than an arm's length past the gunwales anyway. He worried that they wouldn't know they'd found land until they broke apart on the rocks. The seas would rise under them, lifting the Siren until she was perched atop a mountain of water. Then she'd begin to slide down the other side, plunging nose first into a trough between the waves, so deep that rain and salt water mingled together in Brion's mouth. Eventually, his stomach would rejoin his body, and it would happen all over again. Brion watched as the Empress strode up and down the quarterdeck, her hair seething in the wind, barking orders at the helmsman and the first mate, muttering curses at someone named Latham Strangward. It was as if she were in a personal grudge fight against the sea. She knew what she was doing. That was clear enough. Her crew clung to every order like it was a lifeline that would pull them out of the storm and into the blue. Her Highness was clinging to the rail, eyes closed as if she could pretend she was somewhere else. Brion leaned close, shouting to be heard over the wind and waves.
"If she goes down, let go and jump as far as you can so you don't get pulled under. Then swim like the breakers on your tail so you won't get tangled in the lines."
She nodded, so he knew she'd heard him, but said nothing. That was when he remembered that Her Highness couldn't swim. "All right, then."
"Hold my hand,"
he said, prying one of her hands loose from the rail and gripping it.
"Don't let go. When I jump, jump with me."
She gave him that look of hers and said,
"Save yourself, Busker. I would prefer not to be responsible for your drowning."
"If I drown, nobody will miss me," he said.
It was true, now that Aubrey was gone.
"In your case, the fate of the realms hangs in the balance."
That wrung a damp smile from her.
"If I die here, Busker, write me a song. Legends live longer than actual people."
Moments later, they were crushed to the deck, as if the air were a lead weight pressing down on them. Just as Brion began to worry that he might suffocate, the pressure was gone. They seemed to pop through an invisible wall, leaving the howl of the wind and the crash of the waves on the other side. The winds that had been filling the sails and straining the lines to the breaking point died away. The siren glided forward in the sudden silence over a moonlit sea toward an island shrouded in mist and cloud. Overhead, the stars seemed impossibly bright after so many days of gray. Weeping sister, it must be. It was not their day to die after all. Maybe. There was a saying Wax liked to use,
"Out of the frying pan and into the fire."
Brion wondered if it might apply in this case. The princess opened her eyes. They looked at each other, rendered speechless, which was rare for him, personally. As they drew closer, Brion saw the source of the mist. Multiple waterfalls cascaded from the cliffs, sending up clouds of steam when they hit the cold ocean. Fumes erupted from fissures, and the mountainsides were lit with sullen orange wherever lava leaked through. The weeping sister wept scalding tears. Three tall ships were moored in the harbor, sails rolled and bound to the masts. Warehouses, newly built of raw wood, squatted in concentric circles around the quay. Surrounding those was what appeared to be a newborn city, devoted to military and marine purposes, barracks and stables and paddocks, a sprinkling of small stone houses in a uniform gray color. Beyond the warehouses and stretching up the slope were the ruins of a once great city built of timber and stone. Now the roofs had rotted through, the walls had caved in, and stone pillars, monuments to the old gods, had toppled and broken. And there, overlooking the harbor, extending higher than anything else on the shore, was a marble palace, apparently still under construction. It seemed to glow in the moonlight, as if the walls couldn't contain the light within. The center part looked finished, frosted with elaborate carvings of dragons and sea serpents and sirens. Two wings were like broken-off teeth, still ragged at the top, swarming with workers who resembled insects at that distance, working through the night. Brion had an affinity for the music of harbor towns, for the discordant clamor of the flotsam and jetsam that accumulate wherever seafarers come ashore to do business and forget their troubles. They were places where ugly rubbed shoulders with uglier, where utility outranked beauty, where new elbowed forward, embarrassed by the old. It was a place for living and dying, and making bad decisions of all kinds. This looked like no harbor town Brion had ever seen. It was as if it had no soul, no memory, no history, no music at its heart. It told no stories. Brion didn't like it one bit. On the other hand, Her Highness looked cheerier than she had in days. She was probably encouraged by the prospect of stepping onto solid ground again. She stood, chin up, shoulders back, drinking in the view, as if storing it away for future use. The helmsman shouted orders to the rowers as the siren made a graceful turn, coming up alongside the largest of the docks, which was emblazoned with the siren emblem Brion had come to associate with the Empress. The Empress descended from the quarterdeck and strode toward them, smiling.
"Welcome to Celeskard," she said. "You'll be housed in the palace as my honored guests."
Her purple eyes flicked over them.
"I am not surprised that you have an affinity for the sea," she said to Brion. "You have so many gifts."
Impulsively, she drew him into her arms, so that his face was pressed into her leathers, while her other hand toyed with his hair, raising goose flesh across his back and shoulders.
"I have waited so long for this day," she murmured. "We will be so great together, I promise you."
What did she mean by that? Was she speaking of some sort of relationship? Brion's heart slammed around in his chest, as if it might break through skin and bone. Fear and revulsion shuddered through him by turns, and his mage mark seethed and burned. He steeled himself, focused, reaching out, listening for any whisper of song. When it came, it was hauntingly familiar, as if it was already embedded in his bones. He couldn't help thinking, is it really her song, or my own? "This is where it all begins. This is where it all ends. The shattering, the rejoining, forged in the bleeding earth. As it has been, it shall be again. At midsummer, when the sun pauses in the sky." It echoed between them, reverberating into a clamor of notes until he pressed his hands over his ears. But there was no way to shut it out. Finally, blessedly, Celestine released him and turned to Her Highness.
"I trust that you are more capable on land than you are on the water."
It sounded like some sort of threat or warning.
"I am more capable on land," the princess said, with a flash of her usual spirit.
The color had returned to her cheeks. She stood, hands on hips, studying the harbor, the ships, the new-built town, the palace, no doubt looking for any vulnerability or advantage in an impossible fight.
"Good luck, Your Highness," Brion thought.
This thought was interrupted by shouts from the others on the quay. They were pointing at the sky, some crouching and covering their heads with their hands. Brion looked up in time to see a dark shape flap across the face of the moon. It circled once, glittering, then beat it toward the mountains, its flight disjointed, erratic, as if it was injured. They all watched it until it was out of sight. Lys turned to the Empress.
"What was that?"
"Sun dragon," the Empress said. "The mountains in Karthus are infested with them, but we don't see many of them this far north. Most can't make it through the boil, but it's good hunting for those who do."
Chapter 33. The Black Widow. In the days following his visit with the Madelon brothers, Destin wished he could warn Evan that their gambit had failed. But he had no idea where he was. When they'd parted, Evan had mentioned sailing north, which was why, for one heart-stopping moment, Destin had thought that Evan was the prisoner Madelon described, the target of Celestine's attack on Chalk Cliffs, especially when Madelon said that he was from Tarvos. But no, this red-haired busker did not match Evan's description. So, who was it? Was it another mage-marked target that had brought the Empress here? "Be careful, pirate," he thought. "Be smart. Keep moving." In the meantime, he resolved to do whatever he could to keep Celestine from expanding her foothold in the wetlands. He needed a plan. These days, though, it seemed events were moving too fast, spiraling out of control. These days, his plans seemed slapdash and reactive, but he had to try. Destin found Queen Marina on the terrace with the Princess Madeline and a handful of her most trusted ladies, the survivors from among those who had come with her from Tamron when she'd married King Gerard. Whenever Gerard had wanted to punish Marina for some particularly grievous sin, one of her ladies-in-waiting would disappear, to be replaced by a Montane loyalist. It was heartbreaking to watch Marina become more and more isolated. until Destin was put in charge of the disappearing. He stashed the ladies in a temple in Tamron, and they'd gradually returned to their queen since the king's death. The queen spent much of her time on the terrace, or in the gardens, places where there was less risk of eavesdroppers. It was something she'd learned from Gerard. It was a good thing she lived in a warm climate. When she saw Destin, Marina lit up, rising in a rustle of satin and extending her hand for kissing.
"Look, Madeline," she said. "It's Cousin Destin."
Madeline charged at Destin and threw her arms around him. The princess was 9 years old, going on 25. It was no wonder. She'd seen too much in her brief life that was unsuitable for children, or anyone. When the general had dragged Destin back to Arden's court, Marina had welcomed him into her small circle of hurt. She would tend his wounds, both physical and emotional, and he did his best to reciprocate by sharing information and commiseration, by putting as many weapons into her hands as he could.
"Please, sit," the queen said, waving him to a bench.
Destin sat, and Madeline squeezed in beside him. Marina motioned to two of her ladies, who immediately picked up their basilkas and began to play loudly enough to cover the conversation in case anyone was listening. The queen was dressed in black and purple, as was her custom these days.
"Morning suits you, Your Majesty," Destin said.
And it did. She looked happier and healthier than he'd ever seen her. The colors she'd chosen set off her raven curls and tamarack complexion. Marina lifted her skirts and kicked out her feet, exposing bright red shoes.
"I chose these colors in memory of Gerard, to remind me of all the bruises I received at his hands. I don't want to forget that there are worse things than being a young widow."
Destin laughed.
"Things can always get worse, but every now and then they get better."
"Maybe," Marina said, her smile fading. "We'll see. I think Gerard should have died sooner, when Jarrett was younger, and I had more influence over him."
Destin slid a look at the queen. He'd long suspected that Marina knew more about the king's tragic end than she let on. If she did, she had not shared it with him. While they exchanged information, they each had secrets they kept close.
"Speaking of King Jarrett," Destin said, "what news of the young hawk?"
He and the queen often played at pretty speech when discussing the ugliness at court. Madeline leaned toward him.
"My brother has been drinking all afternoon with Charles and George and Luke." She rolled her eyes. "They're disgusting."
Charles and George Barbeau and Luke Granger were members of a group of young lordlings, what the young king called his Privy Council, emphasis on privy. Most were in their early 20s, and so a few years older than Jarrett, and Destin, for that matter. They were the sons of Thane loyalists, and were minor bannermen, with a lot to gain from a relationship with the king. None were tainted by a history with King Gerard, nor were they spoiled by wisdom or experience, or common sense. They were more than happy to take the young king under their tutelage in the study of drinking, hunting, dicing, wenching, and swordplay.
"I've told you to stay away from them," Marina said. "It's not suitable conversation and company for a young lady." "How else am I supposed to find out anything?" Madeline said. "Jarrett was bragging that he's going to marry a northern princess."
It took Destin a moment to process that.
"Really? Does he have one picked out?"
Madeline shrugged.
"There's only one left, isn't there? They were talking about all the women they'd had, and would have. Jarrett said father never bedded a wolf, but he would, and even a wolf could be tamed with the proper—" "Madeline!"
Marina scowled at her daughter and thrust out her hand. Madeline sighed deeply, dug in her tiny purse, pulled out a copper, and dropped it into her mother's hand.
"What's the copper for, Your Highness?" Destin said to Madeline.
"Mama is trying to teach me dis..."
She frowned and looked at Marina. "Discretion, darling," Marina said.
"Whenever I'm indiscreet, I have to pay Mama a copper."
Destin reached behind Madeline's ear and pretended to pull out a silver. He handed it to her and said,
"You were saying?" Mother and daughter both laughed.
"I think it was just Jarrett bragging, like he always does," Madeline said, tucking away the silver.
"I hope so," Destin thought, recalling what Madelon had said about the Northern Queen.
"If your brother means to marry a wolf, you should tell him that wolves eat hawks for dinner," he said.
"No," Marina said sharply. "You should not tell him that. Now, isn't it time for your dance lesson?" "She wants me to leave," Madeline confided in a stage whisper.
She kissed Destin on the cheek, curtsied to her mother, and flounced away. Marina gazed after her.
"She will make somebody a clever queen if she lives that long."
She turned back to Destin, set out two cups, and poured them both some cider.
"What brings you into the garden today?"
It was an odd echo of his garden walks with Gerard, during which he'd receive his marching orders. Destin nodded toward Madeline, a bright spot of color disappearing through the gate.
"Is there anything to what she said? Is there some kind of plan or negotiation with the North afoot?"
Marina sighed.
"Not to my knowledge, Destin, but the king doesn't confide in me much anymore, either. I've been giving him too much counsel that's contrary to his nature. I don't think he trusts me to tell him what he wants to hear. Unfortunately, there are plenty of people at court who will."
She fluffed her skirts and offered him a platter of grapes.
"But enough about our family squabbles. What do you have for me?"
It was part of their unspoken bargain to trade information without getting too specific about sources. Destin sorted through bits of information, setting aside those that were too dangerous to share.
"Do you remember the Empress in the East, who wanted to lend us an army?"
"Of course. That deal fell through, right?"
"Right," Destin said. "But she's brought an army anyway, and invaded the Fells."
He watched the queen closely, and she looked absolutely ambushed. The queen had her own sources, but clearly she hadn't known this was coming either. She leaned forward.
"Does the king know? Is he working with the empress?"
"I was going to ask you that question," Destin said. "My sources, on both sides of the Indio, are usually reliable, especially as regards diplomacy with the Empire. From what I'm hearing, there has been no communication to or from, which suggests that she is acting on her own."
He paused, then continued, knowing that he had to frame this in the right way.
"I think I can say with confidence that the king doesn't know it yet, but he soon will. Jarrett will think this is good news, that it will free him up to act against the Thanes."
Marina raised an eyebrow.
"And you disagree?"
"If King Jarrett thinks it's bad having Queen Rhaesa as a neighbor, wait until he has to contend with Celestine," Destin said. "In just a few years, she has conquered the entire desert coast. Her army is larger than ever, and her soldiers are unstoppable. If she invaded the Fells without an agreement with the Empire, you can bet that this is just the prelude to her coming south."
Queen Marina studied him, as if she suspected there was more to the story than he was letting on.
"Even if what you say is true, which I'm not conceding,
Why shouldn't we bide our time and build our strength while she is busy in the north?
But we aren't building our strength. We're spending men and treasure on a civil war.
Have you spoken to the Thanes about this?
Madelon tried that and failed, Destin thought, and he's a much more appealing spokesperson than I am. If I walked into White Oaks, I'd never walk out again, he said. I'm not the best person to reach out to the rebels.
What is it you want, then?
Marina said, going for the meat of the matter.
What are you hoping will happen?
I would like to see both sides come to the table and end the civil war. Then we can send our armies into the north and help them drive off the Empress.
We've been sending our armies into the north for 25 years, Marina said, laughing. They have not been well received.
One step at a time, Destin said. First, we end the civil war.
Done, Marina said, slapping her hand on the arm of the bench.
Destin released a long breath. Jarrett thinks the Thanes won't attack as long as he holds hostages. He's wrong. Arshal Madelon will be marching on the capital any day now.
And you know this how?
No sources, remember? Destin said. If the rebels reach the city walls, Jarrett will begin killing hostages. If he does, there's no way any of us will survive this war.
You're that sure the Thanes will win?
Destin rocked his hand. I give them 60-40 odds, maybe 70-30. Madelon is a seasoned military commander, the best in the Empire other than the general. Harrisford's no slouch either. Torrance an asshole, but he has lots of bannermen to call upon. Destin paused, tilting his head toward the musicians. Marina gestured, and they retreated a short distance, then resumed playing at full volume. I have it on good authority that Madelon's son, Halston, has returned from the dead to fight alongside them. Everyone who served under him sings his praises. They say he's a soldier's soldier. He has a huge following in the Imperial Army.
He lost 2 big battles this year, Marina said.
Yes, Destin said, looking her straight in the eye. He did. As the general intended. He waited while Marina connected the dots. She never needed an extended explanation.
So, the king's soldiers might desert en masse if they find out that young Captain Madelon is on the other side? She said.
It's possible. It doesn't help that Jarrett has been slow about paying the troops. At least Gerard was smart enough to keep his armies happy. It was time for the ask. If we can remove the hostages from the equation, Jarrett might see reason and negotiate with the Thanes. Marina considered this.
Is there any way they would accept a truce that would allow him to keep his throne and his head?
I don't know, Destin said honestly. It's early yet, and he hasn't committed any unforgivable sin. There's still time for him to show that he's more reasonable than his father. The Thanes really don't want another civil war. They want an end to the war they've been fighting for a quarter century. They want to keep some of their money for a change.
So they can fight another war against the Empress? Marina raised an eyebrow.
Nobody wants that one either, Destin said. But in this case, we may have no choice. Who knows, a show of strength from us might send the Empress back across the Indio, and that would be the best outcome of all.
But you don't believe that will happen, Marina said.
Destin shook his head. No, I don't.
So, you want me to help you free the hostages, the Queen said.
Yes, Destin said, meeting her gaze straight on.
We're talking about women and children, Marina said. They're being kept in the most secure part of the dungeon.
I've been trying to talk Jarrett into moving them into better quarters for months. This is not how you treat people you may need on your side later on. If you try to break them out of the pits, there will be casualties, and that will defeat the purpose.
That's why we have to get them out of the dungeons first. That's where you come in.
It's been a long time since I've wielded a sword, Marina said, flexing her hand. We Tomlins are better with stilettos and poison.
Is that how you did for the king? I have a plan that will not require swordplay, I hope. Next week, you'll be welcoming nobles and emissaries from all over the Empire to celebrate His Majesty's coronation.
Jarrett's coronation had been a hurried, secretive affair after the attack on the city and Gerard's death. Now, 4 months in, he'd decided to host his first major social and diplomatic event to demonstrate the power and stability of the Empire, despite the fractious lords. As regent and queen mother, Marina was King Jarrett's official hostess, since the king had not yet married.
I'm not looking forward to that, Marina said, rolling her eyes.
No? Destin pretended surprise. Didn't Jarrett promise it would be the party of the year?
Compared to what?
Marina nudged a plate of pastries toward him.
Some of the Down Realms' representatives will be staying a month with their families. Why not stay and feast at the king's expense? With so many of the estates under control of the rebels, our larders are nearly empty. That means we'll probably be eating beans and barley cakes until the new crops come in. They'll be feasting and dancing alone, because most of the court is either in rebellion or lying low at their country estates. So it will be on me to entertain them.
She laughed and poured more wine.
Forgive me, I'm not usually one for whining.
Could you invite the hostages to the reception? Wouldn't that help fill up the ballroom?
Marina stared at him.
Have you lost your mind? Why would His Majesty agree to that?
The lords of the Down Realms will be taking Jarrett's measure, Destin said. Here's a young, untried king whose thanes are in rebellion against him. What better way to demonstrate his power than to have the families of the rebellious thanes bending the knee at his coronation and dancing at his reception?
I know some of those ladies, Marina said. Trust me, they won't be bending the knee to Jarrett. It could get ugly.
It will be up to me to convince them to be on their best behavior. We also need to make sure that everyone, down to the babes in arms, attends. Nobody gets left behind.
They'll need clothing, party dresses, and a good scrubbing, Marina said. It wouldn't do a lot for Jarrett's reputation to have them showing up for the reception, looking like they've been kept in a dungeon for months.
She's thinking about logistics, Destin thought. That's a good sign.
If you tell me what is needed, I will do my best to procure it.
You'll need the cooperation of that despicable Luke Granger, Marina said, making a face.
In addition to being the king's drinking companion, Granger had been named the king's bailiff.
Unless you kill him, she said, brightening.
Destin raised both hands, palms out.
Eventually. But not now. Right now, I need to know if you're in the game.
With that, he put a copper on the table between them. It was Tamrik's custom to seal a bargain by putting money on the table, an ante, so to speak. Marina did not hesitate. She laid her coin beside his.
Thank you, Your Majesty. I will keep you apprised of my progress.
He rose, bowed, turned to leave, then swung back toward her.
One more thing, he said. I'm very fond of masquerades.
Chapter 34 The King's Spymaster. Dustin Karn eased his body over the edge of the roof, careful not to send any of the tiles crashing into the castle courtyard below. Anchoring his toes on the stone sill, he poked a foot through the window, verifying that the shutters were open to the breeze. Traveling the high roads of the palace was always easier when the weather was warm. Gripping the top edge of the window, he swung his lower body through and dropped to the floor, mildly pleased with his accomplishment. These days, he spent less time in operations and more on politics and espionage. It was good to know that he hadn't lost his touch completely. It was an opulent suite of rooms by any measure, especially for a bailiff. The king's jailer generally had quarters in the finest part of the dungeon, which, to be honest, wasn't all that fine. This apartment offered a lovely view of the river, yet was high enough so that the stench of that open sewer wouldn't reach it, even in midsummer. It was in the same wing as the royal suite, a sign of the king's favor. The furnishings were rich, some of them centuries old, though they'd seen hard use since this tenant moved in. Destin picked his way through a rubble field of dissipation. Empty wine casks, dirty plates, spilled cups of ale and bingo, random pieces of clothing. The velvet bed curtains had been yanked down and spread before the hearth for a makeshift trysting place. Destin tried not to look too closely, tried not to breathe in the reek of lust and licentiousness. Not that Destin had a problem with a bit of licentiousness. He did have a problem with the man who lived here. Luke Granger had begun as an officer in the King's Guard, who'd managed to get himself assigned to young Prince Jarrett at a time when nobody else wanted the job of babysitting the royal brat. In that role, Granger had spent considerable time wooing the young prince, mostly by enabling Jarrett's worst instincts. With Jarrett's ascendance to the throne, Granger's star rose rapidly. He'd been named captain of the Blackbirds, and then bailiff, giving him responsibility for the guard, the royal prisons, and the courts. Jarrett had recently bestowed on Granger a large holding that belonged to the Madelons. Since Arshall Madelon had been one of the founders of the Thane Rebellion, Jarrett felt free to give his estates away. The king had also approved Granger's betrothal to a rich widow, thus ensuring him a title and a fortune to go along with his estate. That caused some grumbling among the loyal thanes, who disapproved of handing such a fine estate to a commoner. Their outrage was dampened by the fact that the holding was still occupied by Madelon's bannermen, who showed no sign of giving way. Granger seemed to spend much of his time at court, trying to persuade King Jarrett to send an army to enforce his claim. That, and abusing prisoners and tumbling any servant girl he could trap in a back corridor. Granger resented the spymaster's independence from the guard hierarchy. A few months ago, the bailiff had thought he could blackmail Destin with some scandal he'd unearthed. Granger found a dead rat in his bed the next night, tagged with his name. And then his fiancée, a fierce and formidable heiress from the Downrealms, found one in her bed. When she threatened to break off the engagement, Granger reconsidered his choice of a target. More recently, the young thane had been pressuring Jocelyn Fournier, one of the palace seamstresses, to provide an expanded range of services when he came for a fitting. She was another poor choice of a target, because Jocelyn was Destin's friend and one of his most reliable sources. The next time Granger was on his way to a fitting, he was waylaid by a hooded assailant who beat him soundly and promised to improve the fit of his breeches with a quick bit of surgery if he didn't find another tailor. It was possible that Granger suspected Destin's involvement, but he couldn't prove it, which was what counted for now. Destin despised Granger, but he'd learned a long time ago
that even the most despicable person could be useful. Especially a despicable person with a secret. Now, Destin settled in to wait. He might have been tempted to sample some of the bailiff's top-shelf wine, but the risk of poison was too great. Granger had made lots of enemies on his way up. It wasn't long before Destin heard fumbling at the door. Somebody who'd been drinking, judging by how long it took for him to manage the latch. The door slammed open, and Granger stumbled in. Thankfully, he was alone. He kicked the door shut, which nearly put him down on his back. He stumbled to the garderobe and unbuttoned his breeches, hurrying to unburden himself of excess ale. When he turned back around, he found himself facing Destin Carn.
"What the devil are you doing here, you scummer-sucking backhammoning Morley?"
He dragged at his breeches, hurrying to fasten them again.
"I'm not the one with his breeches down," Destin said.
The bailiff blushed hot pink.
"This is my apartment," he said. "You're the intruder. The king is going to hear about this, I promise you."
"Sit down," Destin said. "I need to talk to you." He shoved a stool toward Granger with his foot. Granger's gaze slid to the door, then back to Destin. Maybe, he decided, there was no way he'd reach the door without being intercepted. Maybe, he figured, he'd have more dirt on Destin to take to the king if he stayed and listened. In any event, he sat and regarded Destin through baleful eyes.
"I suppose by now you've heard that the king intends to invite the families of the rebellious thanes to the inauguration reception," Destin said. "He... Right, of course," Granger said, making a rocky recovery. "I think it is exceedingly gracious of him to allow them to participate. It may even present an opportunity for them to redeem themselves."
"Really? How so?" Destin said, assuming the bailiff wasn't referring to an opportunity to escape.
"Once the rebels are defeated and their ringleaders executed, His Majesty will need to dispose of the rebels' holdings. One solution would be to allow those of us who have remained loyal to the crown to marry into the old families, to bring them back into the fold, as it were."
"Good idea," Destin said. "It's too bad that you are already betrothed to Lady..."
"A broken engagement is a small price to pay in the cause of unifying the Empire," Granger said. "You yourself, Lieutenant, might be in need of an advantageous marriage one day soon."
Destin's patience was rapidly eroding. This was not on any list of topics he wanted to discuss with Luke Granger.
"Are you proposing marriage, Granger? This is all so sudden."
Granger flushed.
"I am offering you a word of warning," the jailer snarled. "I have it on good authority that your father's days as general of the armies are coming to an end."
He paused, perhaps expecting Destin to leap to the general's defense.
"I'm sure His Majesty will make his decisions based on performance, just as his father did," Destin said calmly.
Looking disappointed, Granger pressed on.
"Your father was close to King Gerard, but King Jarrett does not share the late king's confidence that the general can deal with a two-front war."
"That's the king's call, of course," Destin said. "Does he have a suitable replacement in mind?" Granger brushed imaginary lint from his sleeve.
"My name has been mentioned."
"Really?
Then may I be the first to offer congratulations," Destin said. "Will you be giving up some of your other jobs, or will you keep them all?"
Granger blinked at him. Clearly, this was intended to keep Destin awake at night, worrying. Indeed, it might, since it practically guaranteed victory to the rebels. Granger against Madelon? That was a mismatch of epic proportions.
"Ah, Granger," Destin thought. "You think you are wielding a big stick, but my stick is so much bigger than yours.
Your mistake is that you think I gained power because of my father. The fact is, I gained power in spite of him.
Then there's the matter of your mother's family, Granger said.
Destin tented his fingertips together.
My mother's family.
Each word was a warning, delivered through gritted teeth. But Granger was oblivious.
She was a Shamble, right?
Is a Shamble, yes, Destin said. Granger had stumbled on the one topic that might get him killed, despite Destin's best intentions.
She's still alive? I didn't know that.
Yes, she is. She prefers to remain at her family's estates in Tamron, Destin said.
She and the General live apart. His Majesty has invited Lord Shamble to come to court, repeatedly.
His Majesty's invitations were more like orders, risky to disobey. But Destin's uncle, his mother's brother, had stayed in Tamron.
Uncle Charles is devoted to my mother, and she is in delicate health, Destin said, as I'm sure he told the king when he sent his regrets. People are saying that the Shambles are sympathetic to the rebellion, Granger persisted. And that's why they are not at court.
Really? What people? Destin said, his voice a river of ice.
Be specific now. I disremember, Granger said, beating a hasty retreat. So, all I'm saying is that you might be able to safeguard your future with the right marriage to someone willing to, overlook your baser proclivities?
Proclivities, Destin thought. An oddly pretentious word for a jailer. All in all, he was growing impatient with Granger and his volleys of verbal darts. Destin's tolerance of fools went only so far.
I think we agree that the king's invitation to the families is gracious and generous, he said, forcing the conversation back where it belonged. But I'm worried that this act of kindness might endanger the king's agenda, and possibly his life. You are?
Granger leaned forward, all ears.
Why is that? Are you questioning the king's judgment?
Not at all, Destin said. I'm concerned that some of the Thanelys might take the opportunity to embarrass King Jarrett in front of his downrealm guests.
That's no problem, Granger said. I'll handle it. I'll use the children as leverage.
No, you will not, Destin thought.
I will handle it, Destin said, but I will need your help. Queen Marina has asked me to accompany her into their quarters. My role is to make the consequences of bad behavior plain. Her role will be to assess what is needed to make them ready for the reception. We believe that is the way to best assure their cooperation.
The Queen? Granger's bluster faded a bit.
The Queen in the pit? Absolutely not. That's no place for a lady.
That's just what I told Her Majesty, and she pointed out that there are at least a dozen ladies down there now, with their children. She is determined to go and invite them personally, then arrange for clothing, bathing, and so on. It would reflect badly on our king if they look as if they've spent months in a dungeon. The irony of this was, of course, lost on Granger, but the potential blowback from allowing the Queen into his domain was not.
I'll need a few days,
Granger muttered, visibly twitchy.
We don't have a few days, Destin said. The reception is a week away. We are coming tomorrow. More importantly, I've received intelligence suggesting that the rebels are planning an attack on the capital, while our downrealm visitors are here. They may intend to embarrass King Jarrett.
or they may intend to achieve through assassination what they haven't done through force of arms. By now, Granger was looking a little ill, as if his hard-won role as jailer and captain of the King's Guard wasn't sitting well. If King Jarrett went down, he could expect no mercy from the Thanes whose families he'd incarcerated. Granger cleared his throat.
"Isn't it your job to prevent that?"
"It's my job to alert the King's Guard when the King may be in danger," Destin said. "That's exactly what I'm doing. It's the job of the King's Guard to protect the royal family. Don't worry, though. If anything happens, we'll both be neck-deep in it."
"If we don't know what's going to happen, and when, then how are we supposed to—"
"As I see it, the biggest point of vulnerability is during the reception, as the ballroom is outside the central keep. It was never meant to be a fortress. So, the King wants to fill out his guest list. The ladies will need someone to dance with. I want a squad of blackbirds in the ballroom. If anything happens, I want them to usher the royal family and the Downrealm guests from the ballroom and into the keep. Keep them there until I give the all clear."
"What about the hostages? I mean, the Thanes' families," Granger said.
"In the event of an attack, we'll want to segregate them from the Downrealm barons and the royal family," Destin said. "I plan to take them to Newgate and secure them there until the danger is over."
"Ah,"
Granger said, nodding, avoiding eye contact.
"That sounds like a good plan."
His expression had shifted from panicked to calculating, and Destin knew he was considering how to turn the situation to his advantage, or find a way to blame Destin if it went wrong. All at once, he seemed eager to bring the interview to a close.
"Is that all, Lieutenant? If so..."
"There's one more thing," Destin said, keeping his seat.
"It's late, Lieutenant," Granger said, "and I'll have much to do tomorrow. Perhaps it can—"
"There is a disturbing rumor that pertains directly to you, Captain Granger," Destin said. "I suspect you'll want to hear it."
"To me?" Granger said.
"You've told me that you grew up in Southgate," Destin said. "The son of a merchant?"
"Yes," Granger snapped. "What of it?"
"Yet I cannot find anyone who remembers you there," Destin said. "Nor any family, nor in the temple, any record of your birth."
"You dared to snoop into my background?"
Granger stood as if to walk out, but of course the conversation was taking place in his room. Awkward. He pointed at the door.
"This interview is over."
"It is my job to investigate those close to the King, in order to identify possible threats and conflicts," Destin said.
"If they don't remember me in Southgate, it's because I left there at an early age," Granger said. "Apparently I didn't make much of an impression."
"I had better luck at Watergate," Destin said. That landed like a cannonball.
"Really?"
Granger said, turning fish-belly pale.
"That's surprising. I'm not sure I even know where that is."
A sheen of sweat appeared on the bailiff's upper lip. He glanced around as if the spymaster's minions might be closing in.
"I spoke to your lady mother, who has high hopes that you will come into your rightful inheritance one day," Destin said. "You spoke to my mother?"
The bailiff went from pale to sheet white.
"If you've hurt her, I'll—"
"Tell me, does the King call you Cousin Luke in private?" With that, Granger drew his sword and lunged at Destin, who dodged aside, stuck out his foot, and sent the bailiff flying so that he landed hard on the hearth, his ornate blade clattering onto the stones. Destin sent flash into the sword, heating it to a dull red. After briefly holding its shape, it subsided into a puddle.
"That was my grandfather's sword!"
Granger crawled forward, tried to pluck the precious stones out of the mess, then yelped and sat back, sucking his fingers.
"Too fancy a blade for a bailiff, don't you think?" Destin said. "Pretentious, really. I take it you haven't told the king who you are.